I'm Drew.
And I'm John.
And you're listening to The Hourchive,
our ever-growing library of everything, 1 hour at a time. You know, the thing, I always
the
have
this
problem.
The thing is in the Fantastic Four.
Clobbering time. I always get that X-Men theme, the intro music, yeah, confused with the opening of Guts, Nickelodeon Guts. Which is, because, well, like the X-Men, yeah, one always goes, do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Yeah. And then, like, the Guts theme is like,
Guts.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, they're similar. Yeah,
no, you're right.
Same era. I, yeah, was probably watching them. There were days where I probably watched both of those shows.
Sure.
I would watch X-Men on Saturday morning, and then Saturday night I would watch Guts.
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 Global Guts. Yeah, man.
But we're not talking about Guts. We already talked about Guts.
We did.
We talked about
Guts a lot, though.
We do, yeah.
Even the outside of the show. It's a common topic of conversation. Yeah.
But we haven't talked about the X-Men.
Yeah, yeah. We talked about them like in passing in other shows, right?
Fleetingly.
I think we mentioned them in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, not as part of the current run, but as a sort of precursor in a way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Setting the stage.
Yeah.
For the Marvel Cinematic Revolution.
Did we go into detail about the X-Men? I think I put forth my theory around how they're actually Wolverine movies and not X-Men
movies.
We did
talk about that. Well, we talked about, in general, how disappointed I am with them, with the X-Men movies.
Right. Maybe we should start at the beginning of sorts. I think the X-Men started in the 60s.
Yeah, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby,
Stanley,
right?
Was Kirby?
I think it was
the
Kirby.
The other dude?
They were the,
I wouldn't be surprised.
The duo.
Dream team.
It came on the later end of that, though. Like, I think...
What came on
the X-Men? End? Like, well, on the later end of that burst of stories. Like, Thor and the Avengers and the Hulk and Spider-Man. And that all started in, like, 60 or 61. And then I feel like the X-Men were a little later than that.
Were those ones not even earlier than the X-Men, though? Like, as far as six... Was that all in the 60s?
Yeah.
Because a lot of those like early heroes like Spider-Man, Captain America and stuff, didn't they come in not in their own title books, but in
amazing
fantasy
anthology stories? Yeah. Yeah. With the exception, I think, like Fantastic Four and Avengers started off on their own.
But... And X-Men started with its own.
X-Men number one.
Yeah.
Issue one.
Which I have a very clear picture of the cover in my head.
Yeah, it's a very striking cover.
It's a strange one.
It's off center, sort of. Like the action is not
You've got Magneto in the foreground, and his back is to the viewer or the reader or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got these little radiating magnetic waves, sort of putting up a shield for himself. And then you have the five original X-Men, and I think Professor X as well.
Yeah.
Sort of attacking him, and they're all, it's really, I don't know if people would agree with me. I think it's actually really a poorly composed cover because everyone's sort of floating in space. There's no, it's not really grounded.
Yeah, there's no background or anything.
Yeah, and so you have, like, Beast is swinging towards Magneto from a bar, maybe from a bar that's hanging from nothing. I want to see if I can find this because, and then Iceman's throwing a snowball at Magneto, so that'll be effective. Of course, it is probably the only thing that'll get through Magneto's magnet.
That's true. It's not made of metal.
Force field. Cyclops is shooting, I think, a beam at him.
Yeah.
Jean Grey is just sort of like hanging out. She's just like,
that's all she ever does,
posing at the thing. And then Angel's got a bazooka or something, and he's sort of up in the sky, pointing it at Magneto. And then I think Professor X is just doing his brain thing.
Yeah. Again, all he
has his.
Thanks for the help, Doc.
Doc?
Professor. Yeah.
I mean, maybe he has a doctorate in something.
I bet he has a doctorate in something.
You have to have a doctorate in mutantology.
He probably created. He founded mutantology.
Yeah. Yeah. That's his. He's a professor of mutantology.
Yeah.
Doctor.
What is
Charles
his,
Xavier?
His
That's a good question.
Professorial qualification.
I don't know.
Like, what, you know, what did he do before? Before he founded Xavier's school, or
right.
did he become a professor strictly because he built this school? And he's like, well, this is my school. I guess that makes me the professor.
I guess. Yeah, because it's a school for gifted youngsters.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Did he have any teaching experience? Did he have any prior? What if that's the big thing? That's the reason the mutants and the X-Men are discriminated against. It's not because they're mutants. It's because their education is considered illegitimate.
Right.
Subpar.
Some like dude who claims to be a professor is teaching children. That's where
it's
all started.
It's basically like the Branch Davidian compound in Waco or whatever that thing was.
In fact, maybe no one had a problem with mutants initially. Like, because they weren't really aware of them. And then this guy starts, like, saying, oh, I'm a professor. They investigate his school because he doesn't have the credentials. And they're
right,
like, oh,
right.
My God, these people have strange abilities.
He's teaching them weird things. Yeah.
Here's the cover. I'm going to pass it over to you.
All right.
And we'll have it on the show notes.
Yes. Yeah.
But I'm.
Yeah.
But Jean Grey, indeed, is simply just flailing in the background. I guess Professor
Standing
X isn't in
on
it, right?
On a fuchsia surface somewhere.
Is she?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're all sort of...
That's
only hint of
right.
any kind of setting is a fuchsia platform that she appears to be balancing on like tiptoes.
I was incorrect. Professor X is not on the cover, but like looking at this, what's great is like Iceman snowballs do seem to be like hitting the force field. And Cyclops, like... It looks like he's got a hand on the force field. Like he's shooting it with his optic blast, but he's also got like he's just holding it. It's a really odd cover.
It's very strange, but it's very like
it's iconic.
It's iconic and it is sort of a hallmark, at least. I mean, I don't feel like I'm an expert at all on Jack Kirby's drawing style, but I know when people talk about Jack
it's
Kirby,
got a lot of his
they're
moves.
Like, you know, he sort of redefined comic panels. And the way that people were depicted, he created the Marvel style, was traditionally known as the Marvel style, which is, you know, a lot more action oriented.
He's
people
missing,
that are captured in poses of action.
Yeah, and like so a lot of foreshortening and stuff like that. What it's missing are the Kirby dots.
Oh, yeah.
The famous Kirby dots. Have we talked about the Kirby dots before?
I don't think we have. We haven't really talked about Kirby.
Yeah, Jack Kirby. Who's a major, major comics. I mean, the guy kind of like set the tone for comics.
Yeah.
One of the people who I would say is responsible for the way comics are.
Yeah, definitely.
Today. Right. I mean, like almost everyone kind of like, followed in Kirby's footsteps in a lot of ways. Like you said, he's known for doing action poses and sort of like, making comics exciting, right? And he's still alive, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Here, I'm gonna look. I've got it. Yeah, he's still. Oh wait, no. Oh man, he died in '94.
Wow.
I thought he was still alive.
I did too.
He was born in 1917. But yeah, let's see. Notable works. I'm looking at his Wikipedia page. Captain America, Fantastic Four, Fourth World, Hulk, Commandy, Manhunter, Newsboy Legion,
Newsboy.
Thor,
Newsboy Legion,
Young Romance.
Oh man, Newsboy Legion.
Young Romance and X-Men. But yeah,
big names.
I know. I mean, like, I know several people sort of in the indie comics world, at least locally here, and everyone's kind of like, "Oh, Kurt, you know, that's the guy."
Yeah, yeah. He, I don't know who is the bigger factor in the X-Men's popularity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think like his drawings obviously collectively are very powerful, I mm-hmm. think, especially from that era. You know, he, like you said, he set the tone and everything.
Yeah.
But I gotta wonder, like, in on an individual basis, like, do the X-Men succeed because his drawings are so dynamic,
right?
Or his character designs are, you know, so unique? Or does the X-Men, was it popular? Did it get popular because of the storyline? And then I guess that gets into the gray area of like, well, who's actually dictating the story? And there's some controversy over
around
that.
Around Stan Lee.
Yeah,
right.
Like how much did Stan Lee actually do?
It's
did
sort of a Kirby... Steve Jobs kind of thing, isn't it? Where like,
Stan Lee,
I think there's some controversy in general around how much in all these books did Stan Lee really contribute sort of story-wise
right.
versus just vision, right?
Because initially, I think he was coming up with the idea.
Yeah,
he would say, he'll call himself the creator of these things or co-creator,
right?
Because he says, "Hey, how about a kid who gets bitten by a radioactive spider and now he's got spider
right.
powers?"
Spider-Man. That's Spider-Man.
And in some
how
cases,
can we do with Stan Lee? I'm trying to think of his voice.
Hi, true believers.
Yeah.
So
true,
imagine
true believers. He,
a the, school for gifted children.
What's the key phrase there?
Excelsior.
Nuff said.
Nuff said. True believer.
True believer. Excelsior. He's got all these phrases that he made popular.
Make mine marvel.
Yeah.
Smiling Jack Kirby or whatever his name is. They all had like, you know, nicknames. The Marvel bullpen.
Oh man.
I mean, I think he's maybe more responsible for making Marvel what it is. You know.
Yeah.
He's the Marvel guy.
Yeah.
And. But I, you do gotta like you look at these things, and especially in recent years, more of this has come out where the actual artists on those books are taking credit for sort of laying the groundwork for the storylines.
Yeah.
Like they would hash out. Maybe Stan Lee says like, "Oh, in this issue they fight Magneto."
Yeah, in this one he's gonna be standing in the foreground, and then Kirby's like, "I'll take care of Stan."
You go.
Write your
funny books. Yeah, I'll. I got this one, Stan.
Make sure you draw my head in the beginning, introducing the story. Fine.
So yeah, they both had a hand in it. Hard to say exactly who really was responsible for making them.
X-Men was different from a lot of. Well, I'm gonna say this. This is all sort of third-hand information on my part. Like, I have not researched this. This is what I've always heard. Is that X-Men was different than a lot of books at the time because the heroes were looked at as villains by the people they were saving, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they were pariahs, right? Mm-hmm. And similar, sort of similar to Spider-Man, right? Spider-Man was a superhero who some people thought was just as bad as the villains he was fighting.
Right. He's sort of cast as a menace.
And he was different in so much as Peter Parker was not like rich and he wasn't, you know, he didn't have a good life. He was kind of, you know, he was a nerd in school and he didn't have any money. And like,
yeah,
he sort of like had a really crappy
lives in his aunt's attic.
Life. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the X-Men were, persecuted and hated by the majority of society within their little world, which was a from what I understand, a very different take on
you don't really
at the time
see that at in any of those other big stories.
Yeah,
you know, and they were teenagers too. I mean, Spider-Man was a teenager,
yeah.
But I think that maybe held some appeal.
It always confused me in a way like that. I think was good because it sort of made me think about it as a kid. But like, I was always like, well, why does Captain America, why does everyone love him? Or why does everyone love the Avengers? Right. But they hate the X-Men. I never understood that.
It's weird. Yeah. Because you don't, like the maybe the Avengers are not a good example because they are. Well, I mean, you could argue like Captain America. So, I mean, he is his physique is enhanced, you mm-hmm. know, superficially, I mean, artificially.
Yeah.
But other than, I guess, him being, you know, he was a project. He was a regular dude who was yeah. made that way versus
yeah.
the X-Men who are born with their
genetic,
unique
yeah.
capabilities or whatever. Yeah, but it does. You got to wonder, like, if this were real, if all of these things existed in
yeah.
in the actual real world, would that be the case? Like, right. would people like Tony Stark be looked at as better than
right.
the X-Men, you know, based on... I guess the question is, would that prejudice about people who are born different,
mm-hmm.
would that supersede the good deeds that
right.
these people are perceived as having done?
Right. Well, and the there's two things I think that we obviously haven't mentioned, but that are taken into account with the X-Men. One of those being that they, you know, the X-Men themselves may be good, but mutants in general in the universe,
right,
there's
right.
so many of them, and who knows who's good and who's bad. And so I think, you know, as far as society was concerned, they're thinking, well, it's better that they're all, you know, take, you know, like subjugated or whatever.
Right.
So we're safe. Then right. we let them all be free. And
right. Because you just can't trust.
Right.
Yeah.
Any
you can't tell
mutant.
A good mutant from a yeah. bad mutant.
Mutie.
Yeah. Mutie.
Yeah.
yeah.
And then the other what the other aspect of that is the narrative function of. They were, when they wrote X-Men, it was a metaphor for equality, mm-hmm. for essentially, you know, minorities and stuff at the time, both women and, you know, race
mm-hmm.
being sort of looked at as lesser within society.
Mm-hmm.
And that was around the time that equal rights movements was starting to kick up, right?
Yeah.
And so the X-Men kind of reflected that. And the mutants were a placeholder for all of those.
Any other minority.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I wonder, like, you know, now, obviously, whenever you ask, if you ask Stan Lee, you're like, well, yeah. so was this, you know,
yeah.
were you making some sort of statement or,
right.
you know, was this done in relation to the movements going on? You know, of course he's like, well, yeah, we thought, you know, this was a great way to reach an audience. You know, they'll sympathize with these characters because they see their plight reflected.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder, like, if that was true, like if they... You know, I mean, because it's kind of a nervy approach.
Are you just asking about their intentions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, was that a natural outgrowth? Did those associations come to light naturally? Like, you know, they're just writing stories about these characters, and eventually you start to see parallels between
yeah.
these two groups, you know? I'm thinking, like, sort of the same thing has been said about Night of the Living Dead, the first Night
uh-huh.
of the Living Dead movie, how that movie, it was supposed to, it reflects the fears of society of
yeah.
You know, like losing control, the status quo is falling apart,
right?
And it's also it has an African American lead, which
mm-hmm.
was not done in that type of movie at the time, so it was considered innovative in that way. But like, there have been all these stories that have come out in later years, and they're like, well, he was the best actor for the job.
Right,
you know, we weren't
right.
making a statement. We weren't, you know,
yeah.
casting somebody who fit a certain, you know, physique or,
yeah.
or, you know, whatever. We just needed somebody who can act, and this guy could act,
right.
but they're given credit for breaking all this new ground.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder, like, is the same thing true of the X-Men, or were they actually thinking that all along? You know, did they look at the world and say, like, this is a... Here's a topical thing.
Yeah.
Let's write a story about it.
It's hard to say. Like, I wonder, I think you could easily, or I could easily see, you know, Stan Lee sitting down and think, you know, coming up with the X-Men, and just by virtue of the fact of what was going on in society around that time, him sort of just coming to the conclusion, well, they'll be hated, you know, these heroes will be hated and they'll be ostracized from society, not thinking, I really want to make a statement. I really want to showcase, you know, how wrong things are right now.
This is the plight of minority groups.
And open children's minds so that when they get of age, like they sympathize with, you know, those who are in a quote unquote lower station or whatever. Like, because in the end, you know, not to diminish it, but at the end of the day, they were just making comics, right?
Right.
And
they're looking to sell books.
Yeah, it was a business, and really at that time it was really becoming a business, right? Like that's with the X-Men, you know, they had started doing these books that were one title, like one, you know, recurring characters, whereas before it's like Amazing Fantasy or Detective Comics or whatever, right? Where it's like you can throw in any stories into these books. Mm-hmm. And you know,
as long as it has fits a loose theme of adventure or mystery or whatever.
And now they're doing these serials, and so like that's really starting to take off, and they're build a readership. So Stan Lee is just tasked with coming up with the next, you know, book,
something that's going to continue to draw people's interest month to month.
So I could see it being kind of a combination of things, which seems sort of like a cop out to that question, but. You know, it seems like the most likely to me that he certainly, I think, was aware of the parallels, but maybe wasn't like, I really want to make a statement, you know? The X-Men didn't do as well in sales with the other franchises.
Which is interesting.
During the 60s. I was just sort of scanning over the Wikipedia article.
Was not an instant hit, instant success.
Well, let's see. Yeah,
it was the first comic to get like rebooted. The first big title like that.
They did the giant size X-Men.
Yeah, I think they did like 93 issues of the regular run, and then they completely relaunched it.
Brand new roster.
Yeah.
Which I had a copy of, not the original, obviously, but a reprint of that.
Giant size
X-Men, which is a pretty incredible. Like that, I feel like at that point, they were very conscious of the societal implications, and similar to Star Trek, which Gene Roddenberry wanted each member of the crew to be like a different nationality or race. The second X-Men team, every member was from a different nation. See, Wolverine was Canadian. So the original roster is Iceman, Beast, Cyclops, Jean Grey, and Angel.
Right.
So five original X-Men. And then the second roster that comes through is Wolverine, who is Canadian, Nightcrawler, who is German.
Oh, he's German?
Yeah.
I thought he was British.
No. Colossus, who's Russian.
Right.
Storm, who's from
South Africa.
Sunfire, who was Japanese, I think. It's a big team. I want to say maybe Dazzler? No.
Was Havoc on that team?
Oh, Warbird? Or is it Thunderbird?
Thunderbird.
Who's Native American. Banshee's from Ireland.
Sunfire's from Japan, and Wolverine's from...
So it was this, and the storyline went that the original team got like captured or something by Krakoa, the living island, right? And then,
oh man, I don't remember that.
Professor X like went out and got a new team to save them.
Gotcha. That's part of the run that I really have no familiarity with. Like I remember reading some of those initial stories, and when I started getting into comics, I looked back on, you know, and looked for the highlights basically. So I knew that it had relaunched with this new team, but I have never read any of those original stories really, and a little from the 70s from that era.
Yeah.
So I have no. This is a major embarrassing admission, but I did not. I got into the X-Men in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I think when a lot of people did.
Yeah.
You know, when there was that sort of third wave of, creator movement.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, like Rob Liefeld, Jim Lee, Todd McFarlane. I think we talked a little bit about them and sort of their rise. All these guys sort of coming up at the same time. Yeah. And Marvel sort of takes that as an opportunity to create new titles and give these artists like their own vehicles, you know, where they pair an artist with a character that they've already started working on and give them like a dedicated run on it.
Oh, I see what you mean.
So like, you know, Todd McFarlane got his own Spider-Man book.
Right.
And then Jim Lee, who had done, I don't know, 30 issues of the X-Men or something, he gets his own X-Men book.
Yeah.
Like they continue Uncanny X-Men, which is what it was called at
and
that
then
point.
And they start X-Men.
And they start just X-Men. Yeah. Yeah. And it's Jim Lee, it's the guy you love drawing the X-Men in his own book about the X-Men.
I feel like that Jim Lee run is where a lot of people from our generation started reading X-Men comics.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that I had gotten some X-Men comics before really getting into them. I think I had inherited a few from my brother, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then the cartoon came on in the 90s on Fox.
Yeah.
And that really got me into it. And so that's when I started buying books. Mm-hmm. And that was around the time that Jim Lee started his run on X-Men. And I remember being so confused by that because I picked up like two issues of number one because it had variant covers.
Yeah.
And
there
I thought
five different covers.
Yeah, and it featured, you know, like two or three different X-Men.
Yeah.
On each.
It was
one
giant panoramic shot that was broken up into five separate covers.
And so I bought two of them, thinking I had like issue one and two or something.
Uh-huh.
And I read the first one, I'm like, that's great. And then I go to read the second one, I'm like, is this the same? This is the same thing, because I didn't know at that point about variant covers and all that stuff, you know. But I have to think that Jim Lee run was kind of like the entry point for a lot of people from our generation coming from the cartoon, you know, watching the cartoon and then getting into the comics from there.
Yeah. It was a pretty brilliant strategy. And I think it was maybe one of the rare points at which that strategy actually paid off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do that now. Comics companies are relaunching stuff all the time and saying like, you know, this is a great point to jump on. If you've never read any of these stories
before.
Well,
they do it all the time now.
Now's a good chance for you to start.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, they're like offering you a new starting point every 6 months or 3 months.
Well,
or
what's interesting is then they didn't reset anything, right? They just sort of like, this is a new title. So you can...
Happening concurrently with the other storylines.
And you were starting fresh in as much as you didn't have to read anything prior to sort of get caught up necessarily. I mean, there were obviously characters that were already established, but storyline-wise, you were starting at number one, right? Mm-hmm. And now what they do is they just completely reboot everything so that, you know, the whole universe and history is wiped out.
Yeah.
And you're reading a brand new sort of a take on these characters.
Which is probably more frustrating than actually having all that backstory.
It is,
To look back on. Because you did, like, I mean, I remember going, like, starting with those Jim Lee books and reading through, you know, a few issues and then being like, well, maybe I want to see what happened before this. You know?
Yeah. Oh, it's great.
And then going back and that whole process... I mean, in a way, the way they do it now really undervalues what's come before. Because they're essentially saying, like, these books over here that have been around for a while, this continuity, that's for all the people who have been reading it. You know, don't worry about that.
Right.
You know, here, we're just going to give you everything you need to start with and jump in. And it's impossible, you know, now to really go back and figure out, like, your mind In my case, yeah. Speaking personally, like I want all of these things to connect somehow.
Yeah.
You know, even if there's some stupid event where like
where it trips.
Suddenly yeah. everybody's powers were gone and yeah. then they woke up the next day and they were back. And
yeah.
It
was but
a whole
different.
Starting point. Yeah. Even if it's something absurd.
Wolverine
like
has
that.
Four claws.
He's actually from Australia. They,
he was from Australia.
Yes. Yes.
In the cartoon, the yes. first cartoon.
His very first appearance.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
In so, cartoon world.
Yeah, 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 on television. It was in an episode of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. They did a guest appearance with the X-Men, and Wolverine is introduced
yeah.
at a table, a buffet table.
Yeah.
And he uses his claw to skewer a bunch of yeah. Fruit, and he says, "How you doing? Want a piece of fruit?"
Which they carry into a like one shot episode that they did of just the X-Men.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which has an amazing theme song that I never knew the words, but I always assumed it was X-Men, X-Men, it's today, X-Men, X-Men, coming your way. And then there's more to it.
That's excellent.
But that had the
excellent.
Oh, that had a lot of the roster that was from that giant size X-Men.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he was Australian in that too. I was like, what?
But yeah, so I feel
and Hugh Jackman
is Australian. We just came full circle. Good work, Marvel.
Enough said.
It was my plan all along. I really wanted Wolverine to be Australian.
You had a dubious.
But we needed to have a Canadian on the team. So I relented. I said, okay, he can be Canadian, all the while in the back of my mind thinking, someday we're going to make this connection come
oh
back around
gosh.
And make him Australian. Excelsior.
Oh, man, that's excellent. Again, excellent. Going back to the idea of, you know, starting fresh, mm-hmm. like the cool thing about the Jim Lee stuff and any of that, you know, where it's not necessarily just rebooting an entire universe, like you said, is you wanted to go back. Like
yeah.
it encouraged you to like, you know, see, okay, where did all this come from? And like back issues were a huge deal at
yeah.
that point. Like I would go and just scour back issues trying to get caught up on the mm-hmm. X-Men and stuff and buy the trade paperbacks and stuff like that. Cause you wanted to feel like you were informed about the characters. Cause they would reference old stuff all the
right.
time.
Yeah. There would be those little asterisks. And
yeah.
It would be like in issue 237.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And what was exciting is there was so much, I
yeah.
mean, there was this huge library that existed, prior to where, you know, you and I were jumping into the comics. Like,
yeah.
And that was exciting to think, oh, man, like, there's so much of this to read.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and so, like, whole storylines that have, you know,
yeah.
have been completed, you know. Like,
and have
full story arcs that you can just go back and jump right into. You know, like, you have the stuff that's ongoing right
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
And you don't know how that's going to go. And you're sort of, it's in a lot of ways, it's kind of like television, I guess, where,
yeah.
like, week to week, you're, like, you're anticipating what's coming up.
Yeah.
But there's a satisfaction in being able to sit down with a full run of installments that compose this full arc.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that with those old books. You can
yeah.
go back and there was, you know, like reference points, you know.
I wonder what people think of the overall the 90s run of X-Men books, because that's the run that I read for the most
mm-hmm.
part. I was fairly involved in the books through the 90s, I would say,
mm-hmm.
and maybe a little bit into the 2000s. That's sort of where I stopped and lost interest in it to
mm-hmm.
a certain degree, because I know I have a feeling that they're kind of that era is kind of looked down upon. It seems like every era is kind of looked down upon apart from the 60s.
Yeah. Yeah. The original run. Well, I think there are highlights, there are periods within all of these, like pockets,
yeah.
that are considered, you know, classics.
Right.
Like the Dark Phoenix
yep.
saga, And then there was like the Savage Land series where, like, I think that's where Rogue was introduced, where it was like the Brotherhood of Mutants, Evil Mutants or whatever. And they did all these battles in like this savage
land.
Country.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like those, there are flashpoints that are considered, you know, classics, but then there are all these, you know, there's peaks and valleys, just like lower points too. And I feel like the thing that that 90s run has operating against it is that it by being part of what was overall, I would say, like, creatively unsuccessful, you know, commercially very successful.
Yeah.
Like it all of those relaunched books and the emphasis on variant covers and all of that stuff.
Oh man. And
like it was a huge seller, you know, it made tons of money, but it was also, it was clear, I think even at the time, that these weren't like super high quality stories, you know?
Yeah.
Like people were just speculating on it. They weren't reading them for the value, the literary value.
Yeah. And at the tail end, I feel like the tail end of the 90s is when the event-based storytelling started happening, right? Because you, like you said, you had events like the Dark Phoenix saga was a whole thing, you know, but it wasn't a like universe affecting thing as much as,
and it wasn't sold that way either.
Yeah.
It was still like, just, you know, this is the X-Men featuring this storyline.
Well, sort of in hindsight that you, that people are attaching it, you know, importance to
they
it.
They label it the Dark Phoenix era or whatever, but it wasn't promoted as that. It wasn't.
Right.
Yeah. Nowadays, it's the opposite. Where it's like this is Onslaught.
Get ready.
This is Onslaught's Revenge.
Yeah,
this
is,
you know,
Heroes
Rise
Reborn.
Of the Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rise of the Thing.
Rise of the Thing. The one event that I loved and that we talked about before was the Age of Apocalypse event that happened in the 90s where Legion, who is Professor X's son, goes back in time to kill Magneto, but instead kills Professor X by accident. Oops.
When are they going to learn this time travel stuff?
It's funny because he goes back out. And then Bishop and Storm and a couple of other people also go back to stop Legion.
Man,
and so then they're
a pattern.
And so then, like, when he kills Professor X, the whole Magneto, like, is like, or Eric Lyncher, as he's known at that point, is like, oh my God, I have to carry on Charles's dream. And so he forms the X-Men. He's a good guy, but he's obviously more edgier, more willing to take steps that Professor X never would have taken.
Mm-hmm.
And in this this timeline, Apocalypse, the villain Apocalypse, who's like the most powerful mutant allegedly, he takes over and kind of like kills most of the humans in the world. So it's more of a dystopia. And the X-Men are all edgier and kind of like, you know,
Mad Max.
Yeah.
Road Warrior.
And it was so, I thought it was so great. Especially because my favorite character, Iceman, was much cooler in this world because he was sort of spikier, like his ice was all jagged and kind of crazy looking as opposed to the smooth Iceman.
Yeah, he wasn't the smooth playboy.
Yeah. and a lot of them also were sort of more powerful because like Magneto would push them to really, you know, push themselves in terms of their powers, because a lot of them sort of hold back because they're worried about, you know, getting hurt or dying. Like Iceman in particular has been classified as like a really powerful mutant, but he doesn't, until recently, hasn't really like taken that on.
Assert himself. Yeah.
Because, you know, initially everyone thought, okay, he just covers his body in ice. And then you find out, oh, his whole body becomes ice. And then there was there was an issue where like he got hurt. This isn't the regular story timeline. I feel like I should just stop.
There's so many layers we could go into with that.
I know, but regardless of timeline, Iceman kind of learns that if he gets damaged while in ice form, so if like someone blows a hole in him, right, because he's made of ice, he can reconstitute himself in human form and be fine. So he could lose an ice arm, grow it back in ice, and then come back,
and he'll be fine.
And he's fine. Which leads also to the ability for him to create other Icemen. Like, basically, he can create a bunch of himself.
Ah.
Which he's been doing a lot in the run that I'm reading now. Mm-hmm. And so, like, he's one of these mutants where his power is always evolving.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to Beast. Beast is a mutant who his power is always kind of, like, changing, particularly in a physical manner.
Mm-hmm.
Because initially Beast is just looks like a man with sort of large hands and large feet, sort of ape-like,
mm-hmm.
or gorilla-like, but just, you know, like a person.
Right.
And then he does, I think he tries to cure himself. He does some experiment on himself, and his mutation evolves, and he's now blue and furry and sort of monster-like.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime in the 2000s, I think, he has a second mutation happen, and he becomes more cat-like, sort of has a lion's head in a way. And then very recently, he's had another mutation happen to him, and now he's back to looking like an ape, but even more so. Like, he's still blue and kind of hairy. He doesn't look like a human, but he's
less cat-like.
Yeah, he's not cat-like. He's ape-like. Yeah. So they're.
I love these descriptors. More gorilla-like,
more salamander-like. If you understand. Yeah, it's interesting the things they do to try to keep the X-Men. Not, I don't want to say relevant, but just interesting because. Mm-hmm. I feel like with all their books, which we've talked about before, they face this they have these characters that have a 50-year legacy now, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how do you make that fresh?
Yeah.
And without, you know, beyond just changing the costumes and the roster.
Right, you know? Which is what they've been doing a lot.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Or they did for a while. That was what it was all based about.
Yeah.
Based on.
But that, I wanted to say, so that Age of Apocalypse thing and For a Time After was drawn by a guy named Joe Madureira.
Oh, yeah.
And he brought in a lot of manga and anime influences in his art style that I think people kind of hated. But I loved it at the time. And then he became involved in another sort of exodus from Marvel that he and several other book sort of runners left and did their own thing, the Cliffhanger comics.
Oh yeah,
which is sort of the second wave after Jim Lee and
that first
and what's his face,
McFarlane, Liefeld,
all left and created Image.
Yeah,
but that he Madureira was sort of famously changing up their costumes a lot, and like people just hated it, I think. And then you have a guy named Quitely.
Frank Quitely?
Yeah, who comes in and kind of makes them gross looking. Like he does this...
that's his style, yeah.
I feel like it is. You know what I'm talking about?
It's like fleshy.
It's exactly. It's very like scrunched faces, lots of wrinkles on everyone, lots of wrinkles in clothes. It's also, at this point, the X-Men movie has come out, and so they've, in the comics, reflected the leather. So everyone's wearing black leather now.
Which this... This is the thing that the whole methodology that especially in Marvel, where when we've got a movie coming out, so we need to cater to quote unquote all of the new readers that are going to be flocking to these books.
Make sure they recognize
because
it.
The movie's out now, so we have to make everything look like it does in the movies, even though the storylines don't cross over usually. They became this. They sort of.
I love that they're worried people will be lost because of the look.
Yeah.
Like, they won't be lost. The storyline's fine.
Yeah.
They'll make the connections.
Some characters that are alive in the movie are dead in the book, but that's not an issue.
Don't worry about
as long as they're wearing leather zip-up suits, everything will be fine.
It was such a bummer because Wolverine stopped wearing his mask.
Oh, yeah.
Which I love that mask.
Yeah. I guess they just felt they couldn't do that in the movie. They couldn't articulate it right.
And fair enough. I understand how that would be a pretty big challenge.
Yeah.
You know, Batman looks dumb with his mask in those movies. Like,
especially when they give him sonar eyes. Can you imagine if Wolverine looks like that?
This is something of a like divergent path. But like, you know, in those, in the Batman movies, his cowl is that kind of rubber, right? Yeah. And so he can't turn his neck. Like, that's always been the thing. But then they figured it out, I guess, for Christian Bale's Batman. They, like, gave him a neck that he can turn his head. Mm-hmm. It looked, but the silhouette's awful. It's terrible. So I feel like even, you know, Batman gets a pass, I think, because it's such an iconic look.
Yeah.
And so, and everyone knows it, you know, whereas Wolverine, people be like, what is this? He's got these giant, like,
well,
fans.
He'd look like the guy that goes, shows up at Marvel Superhero Island at Islands of Adventure.
Yeah.
The costume character, you know, he looks like this block of foam.
It's so excellent. The, what was great though, what that run of the black leather allowed was the return of actual costumes, because Joss Whedon did a run of Amazing X-Men, I think it was called. Astonishing?
One of those. Either, it was some A word. Yeah.
Yeah. And he drastically reduced the team size, I think, to like five again. I think it was Cyclops, Beast, Shadowcat, Wolverine, maybe one other. And they literally have a scene in that book where Cyclops is like, we're going to start wearing costumes again. You know, we're not wearing the black leather anymore. That scares people. And someone, like one of the others, makes comment about the costumes, and Cyclops says something like, we're superheroes. We're supposed to stand out, you know? Mm-hmm. And I thought that's a really cool, like, way to make those valid.
Yeah.
You know, like, they're gods among men.
There's
like
an
they should
ideology
look.
Behind
yeah.
these costumes.
Yeah. yeah. Which is pretty great. And then, Wolverine kind of went back to his mask. Which they made it a lot like his original costume, which where the ear fans, I don't know what to call those.
Yeah, those weird
it's
horn-like things
what's
coming
great,
off
I
his
saw
face.
A drawing where it's like Wolverine's mask is like two Batman masks in profile facing each other. Which is true.
Yeah, it is.
But they his original one, those were a lot smaller, and he had whiskers even. Like going down the side of his face, but he didn't have the whiskers in the new one. But everyone, all of them, kind of went back to a classic look. Like Cyclops had the skull cap again.
Yeah,
for a long time, his hair was out. And yeah, but I was so excited by that. Like it felt like a return to like comic books.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, the fundamentals,
not movies. Because I think, and to some degree, they still do, but. Once the comic book movies started to take off, like the X-Men movies, which were the first, I think, Marvel movies to start to really do well. They kind of made it possible for Spider-Man to happen and stuff like that. But I think that people thought, or maybe Marvel thought, well, you know, like you said, we need them to recognize that people are going to come read the books. When they see the movies, we needed them to recognize them. And maybe no one's taking this seriously because they look silly. And so I feel like there was this sort of cinematic push on comics. And like, to me, comics, the whole idea is like, it can be out there and absurd, and they can have these costumes that would never work on a film screen, you know, and it can work on the comic page. And I love that. With that Joss Whedon run, it felt like going back and embracing that.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't finish that run. I read it for a while, but it still felt pretty cinematic. And part of that was actually because Joss Whedon, I think, purposefully made it always like a 16:9 frame.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. That was a movement across a lot of books, sort of in the 2000s, I guess late 90s and 2000s, where instead of having the sort of square panels model that was popular for a long time, they moved to that more widescreen, movie-like format, and that's still, I think, pretty prevalent now.
Yeah, you do get more variation, at least in the books that I'm reading.
Yeah,
which is important, you know. I think like. I myself, it's funny, this sounds ridiculous, but so I've made a few comics and had them reviewed, and I've been taken to task for doing that cinema. Like, I did it too. I was like, oh, I like that. I like the idea of it being this widescreen each panel. Mm-hmm. And I did that in a book that I made, and it was like someone chided me for not making use of the comic page.
Ah.
Which hit home. I was like, you know, that's right. Like, why? I wasn't really using the panels effectively, mm-hmm. you know, and it really did constrain me in a way that I think was detrimental. Mm-hmm. And so, like, since then, I've tried to really embrace the idea of changing it up,
opening
with the
it
panels,
up,
yeah,
taking advantage of the space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and today now, like, I've been getting back into comics. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe you have too,
yeah,
to a certain degree,
yeah.
And the one that I've been reading is Wolverine and the X-Men. And, you know, back when I was originally reading, I didn't like Wolverine as much as everyone else. I was always kind of like, what's the big deal? You know,
yeah. He's overrated. Cares? He's overrated. The Boba Fett of
Which he
Marvel.
Kind of is. Like, I won't say that's not true. I think he is. But I think they're using him really effectively right now.
Hmm.
Because he is currently in the books... And I am still kind of behind, but in Wolverine and the X-Men, he has reopened a new school. I guess he's opened a new school. He didn't reopen it. But it's essentially like Professor X's school.
Mm-hmm.
But his is Jean Grey's school for something.
For kids who don't read good.
Yeah. Because at this point, Jean Grey's dead. Uh-huh. Again. And she dies a lot in those comics.
Nobody dies like Jean Grey dies.
Ugh. Yeah. And no one mourns for her like Wolverine.
Yeah, that's true.
So he opens a school, and now he's the headmaster. And I really like the parallel. Like, I really enjoy Wolverine, who up to this point, obviously, is the quote-unquote loner of the X-Men. Mm-hmm. He does things his way. He's the wild card. He could go off at any moment. You know, he's had a very storied past, you know, because he has a very long past, and that he is now kind of in a position of leadership. He's trying to live up to the ideals that Xavier set forth. And on the flip side, Cyclops now is somewhat of a villain because he's taken the other extreme and followed more in Magneto's footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
I think because he's felt, I haven't read it, but there's some sort of betrayal he feels, I think, from Professor X. And I think this all comes down from Jean Grey dying, and they had this thing called the Schism. Every event has a name, right? This is the Schism. And it splits the X-Men apart, and a bunch of them go with Cyclops to the extreme side. And Cyclops now believes mutants are superior. We need to do what we can to make sure mutants have a place in this world, regardless of what needs to be done, right? So it's more of a Magneto approach.
Yeah.
And Wolverine's like, no, Xavier had it right. We need to coexist. Yeah.
Which is an interesting dynamic because he's always sort of cast as that rebellion,
yeah.
rebellious figure.
Yeah. Well, it feels like there's an arc, like, to mm-hmm. Wolverine, you know?
Yeah, there's a growth. I mean, I guess in a way, like, you know, there's always been something there.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason, something pulls him
yes.
to that team. You
yeah.
know? Like, he started off as a loner.
Yeah.
And he was a loner for a long time. And something, yeah. a long time.
Long time.
But something compelled him to go with that team dynamic.
But I don't know. It's really cool because they're introducing new characters, but they still have sort of a lot of the old favorites hanging out, you know. And Wolverine is also doing double duty because he's running the school, but at night he's a part of... the new X-Force, which is made of like Wolverine, Deadpool, several other mercenary
combination.
Yeah. it's cool the way they reference that stuff, but I'm really enjoying the new books.
It's nice. Seems like a natural evolution. Like they're not forcing much.
I feel like it's what's nice is I think they have an opportunity right now to just calm everything down and just tell stories,
yeah.
which I feel like they're doing at this point. I'm sure that another event will happen eventually, but this book reminds me of like the early stuff that I read where it's not these broad strokes. It's just mm-hmm. like stories that there is an overarching narrative, but there are smaller stories inside of it. And they're really playing off of this, this huge universe they've created for 50 years. They're pulling from everywhere mm-hmm. and trying to create something new out of it. So awesome. I have high hopes for that. And it makes me want to read the other X books. I think that's the biggest thing in its favor. Like, it's getting me interested in
exploring
going,
that universe.
Yeah, going through it. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to ask, what do you think is so compelling about the X-Men? Like, what? Because for me, I remember just like instantly being like, this is one of the coolest things, you know, mm-hmm. like from the cartoon into the comic, like it grabbed me immediately.
You know, this sort of sounds lame, but it was sort of the I guess backstage drama, mm-hmm. you know, that I found really interesting. It was the first time I'd really seen anything like that. You know, like there are sort of the real world concerns in a lot of books,
yeah.
right? You know, Spider-Man was married when I started reading Spider-Man mm-hmm. books, you know, and had to contend with all of that stuff. And all of these heroes have like some other kind of something else going on, you know, in their lives in addition to the superhero stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't think any of that was that kind of thing was as well articulated as it was when I started reading the X-Men books.
Yeah.
Like the sort of love triangles and the you know, questions about leadership, you know, because there's people are always questioning, like, is this right? Is Xavier off his rocker now? Or,
yeah.
you know, and there's a lot of crossover between the good guys and bad guys.
Yeah,
sort
yeah,
of, you
yeah.
know, like those lines seem a lot grayer in the X books than they do in any other storyline.
Yes.
You know, you don't have too many like
and more
Spider-Man
believable.
Villains. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and people cross over, you know,
yeah.
people, they lean more in one direction and then they start leaning more in the other direction. And, you know, the changes do feel a lot more organic and
yeah.
grounded in those X books than they do in some of the other ones. And again, too, they're accessible, you know, as much as they are not billionaire industrialists.
Right.
They're not, most of them are not super geniuses.
Yeah.
You know, they're just regular people
yeah.
for the most part. So I think that makes it a lot easier to get into them.
I think one of the things for me, which is kind of a narrative cop out in a way, but that I really like is the aspect of it or the fact that they're mutants means that they can have any superpower. Like there's mm-hmm. no end to the potential of superheroes, you know?
Right.
And it allows for really strange characters and really interesting offbeat abilities. You know,
mm-hmm.
there was one character in the 90s called Maggot, who his mutant ability was he had these giant maggots that crawled out of his back, you know? And like what in the world? But it was such a, and he was a good guy too. But it was such an interesting like thing, you know, like I feel like for one, it's a structure that is compelling to both writers and artists because they're not constrained in any way to create something,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a comic book artist can create characters as easily as a writer can in the X mm-hmm. books because you can sort of come up with the look of a character that can inform a mutant ability, you know, and vice versa. A writer can just like say, okay, this is their ability. And that like could translate so many different things visually.
Yeah.
And that allowed for books like X-Force where, Mike Allred and, I think it was Milligan wrote it, came up with just weird characters like Dupe. Dupe was mm-hmm. this little pickle guy and he can put anything in his, like he can eat anything. He has like an infinite stomach or something. And he would transport the X-Men by, or the X-Force by putting them in his mouth. and you had Mr. Sensitive, who also was named Orphan, who his skin was just intensely sensitive to the point of precognition. Like he could sense what was going to happen next, you know, and one guy's sweat was acidic. And like, I feel like it is such an open canvas for weirdness and coolness, you know,
mm-hmm.
that the right people can capitalize on in a really effective way. Mm-hmm. And
unexpectedly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the mutant thing also allows for the switching of sides, you know, in a believable fashion. Like, there was that Civil War thing that happened recently where Tony Stark, I think, was one of the leaders of wanting to get all mutants registered, you know? And to me, I was like, really? Like, Tony Stark is leading that cause? It seems so out of character to me.
Yeah, it seems like a stretch.
Whereas I can see the X, you know, if you're a mutant, you know, you sort of like trying to decide between an allegiance to your quote unquote people or an allegiance to your team, you know? So that to me made those side switching stories more organic, more believable and stuff like that, that it's a whole race of people.
Yeah.
You know,
they have a common fabric
and you're being you're pulled from a lot of different sides. Right.
Yeah.
And so you can have those, changes feel more believable and more interesting.
Agreed.
I think it's a good book. I'm excited to be reading it again. I'm excited for the movies that are coming out.
Stan Lee's excited that you're reading it again.
Yeah, too. He is.
Welcome back, Drew.
Excelsior. So my final thought is X-Men is one of the best books.
X-Men is exceptional.
Hey, put this in the X-Hour guy.
How you doing? Want a piece of fruit?